And now, a takeaway on the tangible effects of climate change.
I was in the cellar when the water came rushing in. It was scary.
The whole street was flooded. There was a dumpster that floated out of the alley. I know everybody saw that video. And then there was trash barrels floating down Farnsworth Street. And the whole thing was just in a matter of seconds underwater.
Residents of Boston there remembering the frightening flooding caused by last month's powerful nor'easter, or what meteorologists were calling the bomb cyclone. Yet despite the warnings we hear from scientists that a warming planet is causing real change like rising waters, the storm's extreme flooding still surprised some people. But climate change expert George Marshall isn't shocked at all that people don't take the risks of climate change more seriously.
There was a set of very famous psychology experiments done back in the 1950s where people were sitting in rooms with smoke coming under the door, and they'd look around and nobody else in the room was doing anything, and they didn't do anything.
In other words,
people take their cues for what they think is important or dangerous or real, primarily from the people around them, more even than the things that they're directly experiencing.
Marshall is the author of Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. He talked with Arun Rath, correspondent of our partner WGBH in Boston, who has been investigating this phenomenon of why we have trouble accepting the tangible effects of climate change.
Climate change has very much become a topic of the left. You know, if you think of the real evangelist of climate change action, that's Al Gore.
We must reverse the silent rising tide of global warming.
Which might be fine as a messenger for you if you're a liberal Democrat, but if you're a conservative, that's sort of a hard person to take on. And if it becomes divided like that and you're in with your peer group thinking this particular way, it's really hard to break out of that thinking.
George, you've witnessed, you've been to the United States to New Jersey on the coast after Hurricane Sandy. What type of reactions did you see when you visited?
I asked people up and down the coast about their experiences with Hurricane Sandy, and the stories that they would tell would be ones of community pride, of a sense of a intense pride, a sense of shared humanity, but people had really come together so strongly around this event, supported each other. And then I asked them, tell me about the last conversation you had with your neighbors and friends about climate change. And nobody could recall for me a single conversation that they'd had. It was clear that what was going on there was not just simply that people weren't talking about it, but they were actively suppressing it. Because it seems to me pretty obvious that if something has happened to you that scientists have been warning for the last 20 years is going to happen, you'd think that it might come up somewhere in the conversation. I have to say, I did a range of research in other places too in the States that had extreme weather events, and the same thing happened again and again. And I think what happens is that people go into a recovery mode. Something traumatic happens to them. They all come together and they are concentrated on working together in a very cooperative way towards recovery. The last thing anybody wants to talk about is any reason for thinking this might happen again. And climate change, as we know, is deeply divisive. So people said to me, they say, why am I going to talk about climate change? I'm really now, for the first time, really close to my Republican next door neighbor. I'm not going to start talking to him about climate change. So you have a divisive issue, and you have a time when people have really come together. They're going to concentrate on that togetherness and not on the divisiveness.
Arun, you cover neuroscience for WGBH. What struck you about how our brains are not exactly quite up to the job when it comes to facing up to climate change?
A funny thing hit me as I was talking to experts like George about this. I've been doing reporting recently on adolescent brain development and what it can tell us about how teenagers make decisions. Behavioral scientists talk about these two decision-making systems. System one, which tends to be our impulsive decisions. They're driven by emotion and immediate context. You know, we might think of our gut decisions. And now that's good when it has you jump out of the way of a speeding car, but it's bad if, say, you do something in anger or irrational like that. Then there's system two, which is the more sophisticated long-term thinking that involves planning and considering consequences, like, say, planning for climate change consequences.
That your house might be flooded or that it might just be destroyed entirely.
Exactly. And because of where their brains are with development, it turns out that adolescents, system one often takes priority over system two because system two, the sophisticated part, the long-range planning part, doesn't kick in as fast. What I learned more recently regarding denial and climate change and talking to people like George is that it seems like when humans are acting in groups when it comes to climate change, we tend to act like adolescents.
This is not a hopeless situation at all. We just need to recognize that this is challenging for us, not impossible.
So we can rewire our brains? Is that what you're
saying? No, we don't rewire at all. We recognize this is the way that we are and that this has actually done very well for us, but we work with it. And I think the way we do that is we recognize that our primary motivations and our primary guidance comes from the people around us and comes in the form of narrative, of stories, of metaphor, and of things which really speak to us and our values. So I think that what we do is we start rebuilding the way we talk about climate change as something which is shared between people in their own values. So that's to say, rather than having a single thing, scientists say this to us, we must do something. We have a Republican narrative on it, and we have an evangelical narrative, and we have a liberal narrative. And each different group of people speak about it in terms of their own values with each other. So we have to have a thing where my recommendation for places that have been hit by extreme weather, for example, is that they start talking within the community, saying, hey, we're really strong. We're really proud of how we came through with that. Now let's start talking about how we're going to build on that community cohesion and work towards the future and the reality which is happening. So a different kind of conversation which is led by locally driven, values-driven narratives, speaking to very different people in different ways. And that we know will speak to the way that our brains work.
Can the media have any influence on that? I know where everyone loves us these days, so just checking.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing the media can stop doing is playing this as if it's some kind of debate. Constantly what we have is this idea that there is a debate going out there and therefore the media have to be balanced and they have to have someone saying climate change is a problem and someone saying it's a myth. We definitely need to move on from that. But the media also has to have different voices, you know, like, please stop talking about this as an environmental issue. It isn't. It's an issue that affects every aspect of our lives. So don't get some guy on from an environmental campaign group. Get somebody on who speaks to a different set of values and a different set of concerns. And we need a much, much wider range of voices on this, particularly people from the right.
Arun, George, thank you for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
George Marshall is co-founder of Climate Outreach, and Arun Rath is correspondent with our partner, WGBH in Boston. You're with me, Tanzina Vega, on The Takeaway today, and we'll be back in a minute.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.